Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Fourth Age. I'm Virginia, and we are continuing today with our read-through of The Gathering Storm. And with me for this episode is Spencer.
Hi, Virginia. Hey, everyone. It's great to be here. Unfortunately, Andrew couldn't join us today, and so we're going to have another episode without him. Unfortunately, we have to actually get these recorded, and so we'd like to have everyone here, but it isn't always possible.
No, we have a lot of, we thought we were starting really early getting all these done, but unfortunately the length of the book and the amount of recording times available to us make it difficult to get it all done, but we're really working on it. We don't want another Knife of Dreams where we're actually still posting some of those last episodes because of the reboot of Dragon Mount. So, there will be spoilers not only of The Gathering Storm, but every single book in The Wheel of Time, including New Spring, and probably any other fantasy or science fiction novel or movie that you think of, because we range far wide, and we will try not to spoil anything for you, and we'll try to give you warning if we do, but be warned now, you may be spoiled. So, moving right into it, picking up where we left off, we are now coming to Chapter 29, Into Bandar Iban. This summary opens with Rand's point of view, and he is riding Tai-Dashar through a gateway into Bandar Iban, accompanied by his retinue, which at this point includes Min, Maurice, Corel, Olivia, Narishma, and several wise ones. He runs through the list of all women who have died for him, Moraine Damodred, Colavir Saigon, Leah, Sindara, Lamel, Andilwin, Jendalin, and then Luz Theron adds Elyena, and then he also adds Min. Rand furiously thinks that Min is still alive, and that was Simarog's work anyway. Thinking of Moraine, Rand wonders if Lanfear is back like a Shalmiel. He hopes he will find Grendel as Asmodian that she was in Ar-Adomon. Rand rides into a square to meet Dobrain, tells Rand that he has one of the merchant council, Milisar Chadmar. Rand wonders if he really trusts Dobrain. He knows Rand intends the Sun Throne for Elaine. Rand adds Simarog and Elza Penfall to his mental list of women who died for him, even though they do not deserve it. He has with him the access key to the Chodan Kal, which he found in Cadswain's apartment. There are only a few seafolk rakers in the port. They ride through the city to the Arandi Square at the center, and then east to Milisar's palace. Rand seriously wonders about the strange power that he tapped into. He wonders if it's something that his Taverinness brings about when he turns unusually violent. There are many Aiel around the palace, and Rand wonders about Avienda, now far to the east. Inside, a couple of maidens, Baralna and Rialin, direct him to the second floor, where Ruark joins him. Rand tells Dobrain that he is sending him and his armsmen to Tyr to tell Darlin to stop sending messages. Rand will summon him in his time after he meets with the Daughter of the Nine Moons. Rand then summons Milisar to him and asks her about King Al-Salam. She is extremely nervous when he demands that she produce the last messenger from the king. Rand then orders runners to bring scribes, stewards, Ruark, and Bale to begin planning grain distribution. He plans to kill Grendel with Balefire as he did Simarog.
And this is kind of really a straightforward chapter. There's not much. I mean, there is the interesting thing of Cadswain and then basic Aes Sedai fashion getting around the, if I ever see your face again, I'll kill you, by just, you know, wearing a cowl all the time so that he can't actually see her face. And he's putting up with it because he's moderated himself a little bit, but not too much.
I think the other thing that we see in this chapter is that we realize that there's still so much that Rand doesn't know. In other words, he doesn't know, for one thing, he doesn't know that Lanfear is back as Sindane. It's interesting that he wonders, you know, about her coming back, and of course he doesn't know that she already has. I was actually kind of shocked that he added Simarog to the list of women who died for him, because she didn't really die for him. She died in battle, you know. But then, you know, he added that dark friend that he killed in the clearing, so
Yeah, well, Elza, I could understand if he added Elza, but Semirog? Really?
No.
It is kind of interesting that Luce Theron attempts to add Min to the list.
Yeah, what's that about?
No, she isn't dead, but when you think about it, if you think about it kind of convoluted, which you may not want to do, you know, it may just be a little bit too crazy, too telling of my own mental imbalance, maybe, I don't know, that I can think like this. But really, she's not dead, but he almost has lost her a little bit, especially since he went to Quendiar. He's trying to become like Quendiar, you know. Everything only makes him stronger, and he cannot break, and okay, whatever. And so I think that might be kind of the angle that Luce Theron's trying to play. She's not dead, but she is gone. He has lost her, even though she's still by his side the whole time, and she still loves him. He still has kind of lost her a little bit.
I suppose, in a way, being so traumatic that you could say that he's really lost her, but I don't think, short of actually killing her, that there's any way that Min will ever leave him. I mean,
I don't think that she will, and I don't think that it's the fact that he was that he tried to kill her. I think it was more what he became after that, you know, the darkness and Gary Rand that he became after he Balefired, well, no, right before he Balefired Semirog.
Right. Dark and Scary Rand is getting darker and scarier by the minute at this point. And, wait, there's more.
Yes, you will see him go completely crazy.
Yeah, crazy scary is right. He is, in a way, like Two-Face. We do know that the old Rand probably lurks in there somewhere. I mean, we see flashes of it now and again.
He even makes mention to, like, a third voice that pops up sometime that just seems like it's very much old Rand. I mean, you have Rand, you have Luce Theron, and then you have the other voice, which is old Rand. And then you have Mord, and then you have all his thoughts. There's a lot of people in that head.
You know, I hate to introduce a crossover so early in the series, and you may not appreciate it. I don't know if you're that far into your Buffy go-through, but he kind of reminds me of Dark Willow at this point, and I almost expect to see, you know, dark lettering crawling down his face and everything as the darkness just becomes more and more absorbed into his nature. And I don't think he even realizes that in this quest to become so hard, he's becoming as dark as he is. He's really going on the path of the people of Eridol. He's embracing what he's trying to fight in order to win. He's becoming Dark Scary Rand more and more. And we really see it in this chapter, and I think it's actually maybe the most important thing in this chapter. When he goes to do what he does in the next chapter or two, when I first read it, it almost seemed to me like one of his impulses, like when he just started feeling better and decided to go see the Sea Folk and decided to go see the, you know, the rebels camped out in Bram Wood or whatever. You know, he jumps up and says, we're going to go see Carolyn Damodred and Darlin Cisnera. Okay, want to see me settle the Sifo? Let's go. It wasn't like that. He's plotting that already in this chapter. He's found this member of the Council of Merchants, and he's looking for the last person that was a messenger to King Alphalon. I mean, this is probably the first seriously premeditated murder that Rand has ever committed. Other than, well, no, I take it back. Scary Rand got Kinsman and Rochade. He went to Farmadding with the express purpose of killing those Ashaman. So I'm wrong. He's done it before, but this is the first time he's done it with a woman.
Very much so, yeah. There's only one point of contention I have to make about what you just said, and that's the fact that you don't think Rand knows what he's done. Actually, in a later chapter, I think it's Conversations with the Dragon. Yeah, it's Conversations with the Dragon. He does know where he's going, and he just doesn't care. It's interesting.
I think it's interesting that so many people, though, are still loyal to Rand, as scary as he's getting. I mean, obviously the Aiel have stayed with him through thick and thin. Min has stayed with him. Nynaeve, Lon, Avienda, of course, and Elaine. And I mean, but the people around him, they can see what's happening to him, but they're not abandoning him. And strangely, none of them are really taking him to task for it except Catswine. She had the nerve to slap the Dragon Reborn practically on their first meeting, so, I mean, what would she not dare? But nobody else is really trying to work with him on that at all. I mean, just really, Catswain and Sorlia.
That's one of the big reasons why I like Cad Swain's character, even though she is highly annoying a large percentage of the time, is because the rest of the people that Rand has surrounded himself with are caught up in the fact that he is the Dragon Reborn, or they're caught up in the fact that he is Rand Al'Thor. Cad Swain isn't. She's just seen another person who is trying to do their best, but is not necessarily doing it what she considers the right way, or what really should be the right way, honestly, sometimes. And so she's trying to help him. She's trying to guide him. And she's not trying to be an advisor to the Dragon Airborne, and she's not trying to be a friend or a confidant to Rand Al'Thor. She is trying to lead this man who is so lost, he doesn't even know where he is.
Yeah. You know, what you said about Rand knows that he's getting darker and scarier and harder, but he just doesn't care. I think he cares still, but I think he's just got it in his mind that that's the only way he can win. And he knows that that's what he has to do. That's the duty that's heavier than a mountain that he just can't put down. I think even he hasn't realized quite how over the edge he really is. I mean, here he is. He's been told by any number of people, Balefire is seriously bad. Don't use it, you know. And I mean, obviously, if it's in a life or death situation like with Cimarron, you do what you have to do. There's just no, you know, there's no condemnation there. I mean, you can't. You have to survive. That's it. But here he is seriously planning to kill Grendel with Balefire, just like that, because he knows that's the only way she won't be coming back. This is so 180 degrees opposite from that cute, sweet little farm boy that we knew in Isle of the World. I mean, he was always one of the serious ones of the three, probably not maybe as much as Perrin, but you know, even Matt would say, you know, Rand was a good guy to be around when he wasn't going all serious and responsible and everything. But he's grown so much, but not all of it's been really good growth. Some of it's just seriously evil.
Well, yeah, we really haven't seen that innocent farm boy since Falme. We have not mm-mm. seen him since then. Since then, at that point, he started his quick downward spiral into what he is now.
He slowly descends into badness, like the Grinch. I remember when, you know, somebody reminded him about a flute or whatever, and then he goes and digs out his flute and begins to play. We see flashes of it. He keeps trying to get it back. He'd like to be that. He just has convinced himself that he has to be, you know, as hard as he needs to be. And he's never gotten across the idea that, and honestly, he's never gotten across the idea that Sorlia and Cad Swain talked about where hard becomes brittle and breaks, strong endures. And the thing that really strikes me as odd is that none of those women has ever sat down and talked with him about that we know of. I mean, why can't they sit down and say, Rand, you're making yourself harder and harder. What you need to be is stronger. And they're not the same thing. I think he'd be open to a discussion like that, or he would have been maybe a few months ago when they first started plotting to try and teach him laughter and tears. I think if they'd have gone about it a little bit more directly and just laid it out for him and said, look, you know, you're becoming what you're trying to defeat. You have to be stronger. You don't want to be evil. I think that might have made the difference, but they didn't do that.
Yeah, but, you know, they were being led by an Aes Sedai, and if they were ever direct about anything, I would eat my shoe.
Except Moraine.
Because otherwise I will be eating shoes, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah. God, I wish Moraine were back, because I think she could do... Although he was getting so suspicious of everyone, even her, I'm not sure it would have made much difference. But I think there's still enough of the old Rand left where if Cad Swain and Sorlia had ever sat down and said, we really need to talk, Rand. We know what you have to do. We're behind you 100%. We see what's happening to you, and we think you need to look at this a little bit more closely and maybe make a few changes that will help you do what you need to do without destroying what's you. I think he might have been open to that if they'd approached it in the right way. And I don't understand why even a tricksy Aes Sedai couldn't figure that out. Why do they have to try and do it the roundabout hard way? Because they have Kempswain is so direct in every other way. She doesn't want him to use Balefire. She rails him. I mean, she goes up and slaps him and says, "You'll never do that again, boy." You know, she's not really that subtle all the time. Why she couldn't just sit down and talk to him, I don't know. I don't know why Viren didn't do it either. Of course, Viren, you know, is black, but we don't, you know, she wasn't truly black. And I think she wanted Rand to succeed, and she definitely had the goal of trying to get him to the last battle alive enough to do what he needed to do, which was defeat the Dark One, or to face the Dark One anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, she set every single one of the Aes Sedai in the, basically in the camp to doing that, too. All the ones that they picked up after Jumane's Wells, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk a lot more about how the Aes Sedai are handling Scary Ranch. You know, the other thing that kind of surprises me is that the Wise Ones have never really, and Avienda has never really gone there with Rand. They can see it. They all see it. And yet, I mean, if I really loved somebody and I saw them going down a path like that, I would be probably, they'd probably balefire me because I would have any number of conversations on this subject with them because I would not be able to let it rest because I don't want to see somebody I love go down that road because it isn't really necessary in order to win the last battle for him to be as evil and hard and horrible as the Dark One. I mean, he doesn't need to become the Dark One to try and defeat him. And he can't seem to understand that. He's so obsessed with his destiny, you know. Just sort of going down a little Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader path here that I really would just assume he not do. I mean, I have wondered a number of times up until obviously later in this book if that wasn't where we were going, where Rand would actually end up becoming so evil that he became the Dark One's champion. And I was actually considering the possibility that there could be a complete role reversal wherein if Rand became the Dark One's champion and Maedhlis and et cetera, that Moradin would then switch sides. But I don't think that's going to happen now the way that this book has gone. So, and I'm kind of glad because I really didn't want to see that. That was a really crazy theory. But I'm not sorry to see that one go.
Yeah. Well, I think that neither RJ nor Brandon would have let it go that way, although they are both masters such that they wrote it such that you were worried that it would.
Yeah, I hope
but,
so.
But yeah, if Rand had gone to the dark side, I think there would have been a lot of people that would have lynched Brandon.
Well, but...
Because I don't think any of us would have accepted that was the way that RJ wanted it to go. We would have been like, no, Brandon must have changed it. Brandon must have changed it. And so we'd lynch Brandon. But it's okay, because it didn't go that way, so everything's good.
Well, I've had the benefit of meeting Brandon and spending a little bit of time with him a couple of times. I can't say he's my bosom buddy, but I feel like I know him well enough to know that he would not do anything that wasn't in Robert Jordan's notes. I have absolute confidence that if he's changed anything that Robert Jordan intended, it's because it was never written down or indicated in a fashion that made it obvious to him. And I think that enough other people involved in the series, in particular Harriet, and also our friends at Team Jordan, Alan and Maria, they knew at the end because Robert Jordan sat them down and told them where this book was going. So I don't think a major plot line like that would ever be changed by Brandon, nor interpreted.
No, it wouldn't.
Something minor character, you know, where it wasn't clearly indicated what was going to happen. Okay. Then if it wasn't clearly indicated, Brandon has to resolve it. He'll do what he thinks is best because there was no guidance. But I am 100% certain under the light that Brandon Sanderson would never, never intentionally or consciously change anything that Robert Jordan wanted if he knew what it was. So
yes.
That I'm going to say that right now. Right now, I swear to lie, I do not ever believe that Brandon would ever change a line or a thought that Robert Jordan had. He'll have to make stuff up if it doesn't exist. But he's Brandon is an incredible person. He's one of the few people that impressed me so much at first meeting that I can't even tell you. And one of the things that impressed me the most about him was his sincerity and his love for the Wheel of Time. I mean, he was a fan of this series before he was ever tapped to complete it. So this is absolutely like a dream come true for him, although I wonder now sometimes the schedule he has to keep if it's not a dream with a little bit of a bite to it. But
I don't think it is, really. I think he loves doing this so much that he wouldn't care what he would have to do to get it done.
But I know, what I'm worried about with Brandon is that he's going to go off on a little Randolph Fuller thing. He's going to not necessarily become evil, but he's going to use himself up in his quest to fulfill all of his obligations, because he had other obligations as well as the Wheel of Time. And look at what the man has done just in the last year or so. He finished, he finished one of his Alcatraz books. He did, Warbreaker came out last year, but just about a year ago. He's done a couple of small tours, and he's put out the first book of The Way of Kings, which I know he had started on, but I don't think he started on that far when he started finishing the time. He got The Gathering Storm out on schedule last year. He's going to have The Towers of Midnight on schedule this year. They only missed it by a week or so, and I think that was a publishing thing rather than Brandon not getting it done on time. I mean, it's incredible. I joke that I think he's an android. He's awfully big and cute and cuddly for an android, but you wonder sometimes.
Yeah, that or he's a warder.
he's a warder.
Android or he's a warder.
One of the two. I mean, the man has such an incredible capacity for work and quality work. You know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not just churning out penny dime store novels here. He's churning out major epic fantasy of a world class quality. So, you know, the guy has nothing but my admiration, but one thing I would bank my life on is that he is 100% sincere and 100% dedicated to doing exactly what Robert Jordan wanted with this. So, that's my opinion. The guys could lynch me if I turn out to be wrong.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. Honestly, I do. Just a second.
Yeah, I don't think so. But anyway, we sort of diverged there on a little tangent, and again, my fault.
Well, you know, I agree with your tangent, and I think it was a good diversion.
I think we should.
And honestly, Brandon is a great author in his own right. I mean, he came out with Way of Kings, the first book in an epic series, and it hit number 7 on the New York Times bestsellers list. That doesn't happen for first books.
No,
unless you are an amazing author, which he is.
Yeah, well, it's not his first book. It's just the first book in that series. He was.
Oh yeah.
He got on the New York Times bestseller list with the third Mistborn. In fact, it was so cute when.
He did that too.
Year before last, when Jesse and I got to spend most of the day with him, which was so fantastic, I can't even tell you. You know, we met him, did our interview, and then Jesse and I offered to drive him around because, you know, he had hotels all over L.A. I mean, he had one hotel, but all of his appointments were all over L.A., and driving around L.A. in, you know, daytime traffic is not a lot of fun for somebody who's not that familiar with it. And it's so easy to massively, you know, underestimate the amount of time required because of traffic situations. So I got to be his chauffeur for the day, which was great fun, and we went to several of his appointments. It was great. And while we were at the book signing, while we were setting up, a floral arrangement arrived at the bookstore for Brandon with a note that from his publisher, from Tor, Tom Doherty, that he had, or maybe it was his agent, that he had hit the New York Times bestseller list with the third Mistborn book, whose name now escapes me.
Hero of Ages.
Thank you. I had a moment of gum there. He had actually just come out that, you know, like within an hour or something, that he had hit the New York Times bestseller list with Hero of Ages, the last book in the Mistborn series. And you know, that he was so touched and overwhelmed, you know. That's quite an accomplishment for a relatively new author. I mean, he had quite a body of work already published, but that's a big deal for any fantasy novelist at all, to hit the New York Times bestseller list. And now he's done it not only with the first one in Way of Kings, but it's almost a guaranteed, you know, almost a guaranteed dead cert that he's going to do it with Towers of Midnight, too. And
Towers of Midnight will hit number one easy.
Yeah.
Gathering Storm was number one at one point in time. Gathering Storm was number one. It knocked off Dan Brown's new book.
Oh, my gosh, and that's going some. You know, you talk about somebody who has wide audience appeal. Dan Brown, oh, my goodness, you know.
Well, it was 7 weeks after initial release, but still.
Yeah, but still. Dan Brown's grocery list would probably make number one on the New York Times bestseller if he decided to publish it. You know, that's clout.
I would love to see that.
Dan Brown, the grocery list.
It would probably be encrypted with some secret society's code or whatever, you know.
Oh, yeah. You know it would be a thriller. You know it would be. I challenge you, Dan Brown, if you ever listen to this, make that book, The Grocery
yeah,
List.
Yeah, The Grocery List. And send Virginia royalties on that because it was my idea. Yeah, that's going to happen. Okay. Well,
anyway.
Now I've really managed to hijack this this train of thought. So I think we'll, unless you have any other comments on good old chapter 29.
No, I think we're done with chapter 29. And we're going to go on now to chapter 30, Old Advice. This is from Gawain's point of view. He's in the Rebel Aes Sedai camp, and he remembers a time when his father had been talking to Galad, and he warned him that he should always be wary against pretty women and Aes Sedai. And right now he's arguing with Lelane, who is both a pretty woman and an Aes Sedai, so she's double trouble, and he's trying to convince her to rescue Egwene. She says that Egwene is not in danger, as Elida does not consider her a threat. Bullying Brian has not worked either. Romanda gives him the same answer, so he's running the gamut here. Lelane proceeds to question him about Elaine's taxing policies. Gawain has no idea why. And after he finally escapes from her clutches, he rides Challenge out to an army camp outpost to meet Brian. They discuss the younglings, and Gawain refuses to betray them. Gawain still thinks that Rand is a monster who must be killed. Brian asks Gawain if he understands his true allegiances. Whom does he serve? Brian was not sure himself when he was captain in the Io War, but Laman got what he deserved. He then served Morgaith, but she failed him. He now serves the rebels because it is the right thing to do. Gawain feels that something bad is coming, but he does not understand the different sides and does not know what to do. Gawain, you're an idiot.
And is Virginia still there, or is she?
Yeah, I'm still there. I'm sorry. I thought there was more. I looked away for a second, and I thought there was more. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. It's a short chapter. We just get some of the internal ramblings of Gawain, who is an idiot, about most things. Honestly, Egwene, he's been to the rebel camp. He sees that the Aes Sedai literally respect Egwene as Amyrlin, and they do what she says. She said, don't come rescue me, and he's still belaboring the point.
I know. Well, we talked about this in the last episode.
In the last Gawain chapter, yeah.
Yeah, is he laboring under some sort of compulsion? Because
well, yeah, that too. I mean, he's been told repeatedly by so many different people, by so many different sources, that Rand did not kill Morgaith. And I'm talking to Brian, he's told, even if Rand did kill Morgaith, which I don't think he did, he probably did us a favor, because as soon as she got in with Robin, who was, what, Gabriel? I think was what
yeah,
he was known
Gabriel,
as.
Yeah.
As soon as she got in with Gabriel, she stopped caring about the country. And she stopped being a good queen. And when she was removed, it was a good thing. Of course,
yeah,
Brian didn't realize. Brian didn't realize that Morgaith had run away, Gabriel had taken over, and then Rand came in and wiped out Robin. And that's the whole story. Egwene doesn't know it. Brian doesn't know it. The people that do know it have told them, though. Egwene has been told what happened, and he refuses to accept it.
Yeah.
I hope. I really, really hope that he is under compulsion.
Yeah.
Because I liked him as a character, and I still kind of do with the proviso that I hope he's under compulsion. Because if he's not, then he's the biggest idiot we have yet to meet. And that's going some, because we have Rand, and we have some others. We have Elida, but Gawain is the biggest idiot. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He's not as big an idiot as Elida.
No,
but
nobody
other than
could
that,
be.
He's the biggest idiot.
Yeah. I was going to say that all of this is really out of character for Gawain, but, you know, really, we don't see enough of him to really know that before. I mean, we've only met him briefly, but even when he was with, you know, I don't know. Not to strike that, because we don't really know enough about him to know what his true character is. We don't see him that often until he finally, you know, gets together with Egwene and Carian and et cetera, et cetera. But it's just, he seems such a good, sensible person. And Elaine, his sister, is pretty much a good, sensible person. And, of course, his mother is. But that's no guarantee that the brother will be. I mean, there are plenty of cases in real life as well as fantasy fiction where one one sibling is upright, upstanding, and sensible, and the other one's a, you know, goofball, swibber to gibbet, wastrel, you know. So, I don't know, but he seems like a really solid sort of young man, and so this sort of obsession, it really does make me think there's something else going on, and I don't know if we'll ever get that resolved. I wonder, I know Varen said that her type of compulsion couldn't be detected by delving, but I wonder if other types of compulsion can really be seriously detected. Did Rand detect it in the messenger in the next chapter?
Nynaeve did. She didn't know what she saw, but she did detect it, and Rand told her what it was and how to get rid of it. So, it seems to me, and I could be completely off, but it seems to me like everyone's form of compulsion is just a little bit different. I mean, we got Varen, who obviously she's trying to make this up from scratch, and so she has this big complicated weave. But then we have Mogheedon and her compulsion, and then we have Grendel and her identity takeover. It's not really compulsion. It's a complete takeover of the mind, and it's just...
Wait, what?
Grendel's compulsion completely basically wipes the slate clean and creates whatever she wants them to be.
No. I don't agree with that. It's just, it renders them pretty much useless for anything else, but I don't think it actually destroys and wipes the slate clean. I think it just submerges everything else under her weave. I think
and yet when their weave disappears, they die.
Where do we see that?
When Nynaeve takes the compulsion off the messenger, he has a few seconds of lucidity and then he dies. He's a vegetable for a few seconds, able to get off a little bit to Rand so that he knows where Grendel is, and then he dies.
Okay, well, then I stand corrected. I didn't think that it was such a complete takeover, but I know they submerged the personality really badly, but I thought that maybe if the compulsion was removed, it could come back. It could come back, but I'm wrong. Okay.
Well, it could just be that Nynaeve doesn't have enough experience removing the compulsions to be able to bring them back. Because we see Semerog remove the compulsion of Elza. Mind you, that's Varen's compulsion, which is different than Grendel's, but still. And so,
yeah, but Semerog is a noted healer, so she may have knowledge that, as you say, Nynaeve just doesn't have yet.
Yeah, and so it could you could very well be right. It could just be Nynaeve's inexperience that led to his death. But it seems to me like she doesn't just submerge their personality. She takes them over. It's how it reads to me. And then Masana, not Masana's, but Mogheedon is much more of a general influencing. I want you to do this, which is kind of the thing that we see Gawain doing. If it's a compulsion, it's, I want you to hate Rand. That's what you're going to do. Or when Mogheedon went against, Nynaeve, when we saw that, it was, I want you to like me, I want you to love me, I want you to tell me everything you know because you want to please me.
Right, you worship me, I'm fabulous.
Yeah, which is kind of the same thing she did on Leandra that one time.
Yeah, actually, even Varen's type of compulsion would have worked on Gawain. The compulsion that Varen did required that the person find reasons within themselves to do what she wanted, and Gawain certainly was able to dredge up enough of that from his own, you know, background and everything because of his love for his sister and his mother and so forth and what he had heard rumored. He would have found plenty of reasons to go along with that, so I don't think it would have taken much, but the level of the obsession, I guess, is what we're questioning, why he still hangs on to that even though everybody's telling him the opposite. And yet Gawain is sensitive enough that he feels something bad is coming. He senses that something's happening, but he just doesn't understand. He doesn't know enough about the different sides that he's involved in the situation, so he just doesn't know what to do. I mean, he's a very confused young man, and justifiably so. I think anybody would be confused. You gotta kind of feel bad for him, really.
Yeah, you do. You really do. I mean, I think this is why he's here. You see the normal person. He's not a Taveren, he's not a Channeler, he's just a normal soldier. Mind you, he is First Prince of the Ravens, but still. He's just a normal person.
Not First Prince of the Ravens.
First Prince of the
First
Sword,
Prince
oh
the
my
sword.
Gosh.
Yeah.
No, the Prince of Ravens is very much Matt.
Yeah. And I think there's only one, so there's no first. I think he's just First Prince of the Sword, so.
Yeah, I mean, he's First Prince of the Sword, but really, that's his only thing. He's not a Channeler, he's not Taveren in any way. He's not special in any way other than he's really good with a sword and he's a really good commander, soldier person. That's his special.
Well, I think Gawain has it in him to be one of the great captains eventually, and he's certainly, you know, a blade master, just as his brother, Gawain, is.
Yeah, it would be special in the normal world, which even in normal time Randland, but it isn't in right now. You have the world in so much turmoil that you have the powerful, whether they're powerful channelers or Taverin or whatever they are, that you have the powerful people, and then you have Gawain and kind of Bryn as well. Bryn. Yeah.
Bryn. Yeah, I think she said it was Bryn.
And you have them that are kind of the normal people that are just caught up in the swirl, and you're seeing what it's doing to them. And I think that's really, really a cool point of view to go from, a nice angle for the whole story.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. But I have to say that maybe one tiny criticism I have of the whole series, and we can explain it away by the pattern needs so many really super people in order to try and write itself, but there is an overabundance of seriously good special people in this book. I mean, the three girls, the three boys, you know, Gawain, Gala, there's so many really awesome, strong, you know, characters, whether they're Lon. I mean, you know, oh my goodness. Guy is death personified. There's just so many really exceptional people running around. It's kind of scary when you think about it. I mean, you couldn't probably find a country or even a continent where you could find that many amazingly outstanding, over the top, exceptional people involved in stuff. So that kind of bothers me. But that's the nature of fantasy. I mean, there has to be. Everything is more and exaggerated, you know, in the fantasy world. It's above the mundane, which it has to be. Otherwise, it wouldn't be really interesting. It would just be a day-to-day account of the lives of people in different settings.
Can you imagine if this whole series was written from the point of view of Elsa Penfell?
Oh, boy.
With Elsa Penfell being the Elsa Penfell that she is in the stories, obviously, if it was written from her point of view, it would be written in such a way that she was an exciting character. But if she was the character that she is now and we were trying to get the whole story from her point of view, oh my gosh.
Well, I don't know. It's just the nature of epic fantasy. There's exceptional situations, so you have to have exceptional characters, but we seriously have a lot of them in this book. And I guess it's just because it's such a wide scale book, you know, it's a big world and there are a lot of people. And so I guess it stands to reason. The other thing that we sort of notice in passing, which actually would have escaped me if it weren't for the notes, and thank you, I have to take a second here. We should have done it at the beginning to thank encyclopedia-watt.org for the fantastic chapter notes, which we are borrowing from heavily, if not reading outright. And they note that Juan planted the seed that Ramonda So that Swan planted the seed with Ramonda so that she is now interested in Andorran politics, but apparently she was not before. And I wonder, why did she do that? You know, Swan's another master manipulator. Swan doesn't do anything by happenstance. Was she doing that on her own account, or was that an order from Egwene? Why get Ramonda involved in the politics of Andor? Who needs her involved in anything?
Well, it wasn't really getting Ramonda involved in the politics wasn't the point. It was getting Ramonda and Egwene to quarrel something and to foil each other such that neither of them could rise to the top and basically take over where the void where Egwene should be. Because Egwene's not there. Egwene's in the White Tower right now. She's still meeting with the Hall on a semi-regular basis using the Dream Triangle, using Teleron on Riad. But honestly, there is a power void there. There is a power vacuum. Because she cannot exert her authority as much as she needs to in the Rebel camp. And that's what Suwan's doing. Suwan is keeping them is keeping them bickering with each other such that they can't actually fill the space.
Yeah. No, I know Elaine and Ramonda have been contesting for, you know, basically this Amarlin seat forever, and they, either one of them would unseat Egwene in a heartbeat if they could. So I guess it was just a little butter for the cat's paws, as Sawan says. Elaine was the one that wanted all talk of the Black Aja in Celador to be banned. That's kind of odd.
Yeah, I had to agree with Egwene in a later chapter after she gets the special book. She's kind of upset that Lelaine and Ramonda, neither of them are listed in it.
She really suspected them, I think.
I did. And I'm upset that they weren't listed. I'm upset that they both got through, honestly. I don't like either of them. But just because I don't like them doesn't mean they have to be black.
That's true. I have to say that I still am of the feeling that there are more Black Aja around that Varin missed. I know she got most of them. I know she got a lot of them. But I don't think she got them all.
Well, I don't think that any of the Black Aja could have gotten past the Othrod test.
Well, probably not. We don't know that they can. Yeah, I guess. If she tested everybody with the Othrod and Lelaine was there, that would have done it. But, you know, the Black Aja is tricksy, and if there was a suspicion that this would happen, that the Blacks could have quickly had their O's removed, taken the 3 O's for the White Tower, and then switched O's again, it wouldn't be pleasant.
To take the oath, and then they had to swear, I am not a Black Aja, or I am not a Dark Friend, or whatever. And I don't think they could. I think that Nisana could have, because as a quote-unquote chosen, she thinks that I'm better, I'm not really a Dark Friend, I'm not really a Black Aja, I'm above that.
Right.
And so she could have gotten by saying, I'm not a Dark Friend. I think she could have bypassed the oath that way. I don't think that any of the Black Aja sisters could have. Maybe they could. Because if they could convince themselves that when they forsake all oaths that bind, they are no longer part of the Black Aja. I mean, they're still Dark Friends, but they can say, I am not Black Aja. And if they can convince themselves that it's true, that is scary. That is very scary.
Well, that's basically what Varin did. She convinced herself that this was the last hour of her life, and so she was able to recall. You know, yeah, if you can convince yourself seriously, you can get around that. So, yeah, I could see it could happen, especially if, say, we don't know what weaves the Forsaken or whatever have. I mean, Nisana could have taken a few of her closest cronies in the Black Aja or the new heads of the Black Aja or whatever, and I'm wondering if some sort of compulsion might not have actually been sufficient to make them believe that the Osu removed, that they are no longer a Dark Friend, that they aren't Black Aja, and that they can take the Osu again. Because if they believe it, they can do it. And, you know, a person can even just be hypnotized to believe something is true at this point in our time, and that's really low level compared to compulsion. I mean, it's very difficult even under hypnosis to make somebody do or say something they don't believe, but it can be done. You know, you could convince somebody of it long enough, but yeah, I could see them laying a weave of compulsion on a Black sister saying that when these O's are removed, you are no longer Black Aja, and you were never really just a Dark Friend. So, take the O's, and then we'll get back to you. That would be pretty tricksy, but it could work.
You know what, let's save the rest of this conversation for when we get to those chapters. How's that for an idea?
Okay. Well, you can probably leave it in there, but we'll come back to it.
Well, we will definitely come back to it when we get to those chapters. Shall we move on?
Oh, goody, I get to read Canceling Chapter 31, which is entitled The Promise to Lutheran. This chapter is from Canceling's point of view, and we open with her walking through Bandar Iban to the Wind's Favor, which is a local inn. The innkeeper, Quillen Tafil, is a good source of information. He is Andoran, but his wife is a retired wealthy Damani merchant. His daughter, Namin, is Brown Aja and works in the Tower Library. Canceling asks him about Al-Salam, and Quillen says no one has really seen him in half a year. there are 24,000 Ainu in the city at this moment in time, and Rand's Taviran effect is now all negative with no positive balance. That's pretty scary. After she leaves the inn, Catswain plans what she should do next. She realizes that she has seriously mishandled Rand. The sad bracelets were not her fault, but he'll never be made to see that. The Shanchen had made others so that one was taken specifically to sow mistrust. As she approaches the docks, she turns to see Rand and his entourage approaching her. She seems to accidentally run into him quite often. She still sees darkness around him from the corner of her eye, and it terrifies her. She has failed trying to guide him, and now he trusts no one but men. She then returns to the mansion where Aiel now camp where Dobraine had his men. She goes to the Wise Ones area and finds Sorlia, Amis, and others. Catswain admits that she has failed with Rand, and the Wise Ones say that she has no toe to them. She says that she has a plan, and they want to hear it.
Well, this is very interesting. First off, I think it is the note from Encyclopedia Watt again is that Catswain and Rand seem to be accidentally running into each other quite often. And this is really interesting. I mean, is the pattern pulling them together? Is there some reason that Rand's Taviran-ness is pulling Catswain to him, or is there something else? Is it actually, well, no, it can't actually be coincidence, not in this world.
No, and I think it's absolutely the pulling of the pattern to throw them together, because if you remember, Min had the viewing that Catswain was going to teach him something, and all the Ashaman actually, and they wouldn't like it, but they needed to hear it. So Catswain, we know from that, or we're pretty sure from that, we can infer that she's not yet managed to teach him whatever she needed by the pattern to teach him. And so the pattern is going to continually throw them together. And apparently nobody but Catswain can do this for him. The pattern hasn't thrown anybody else up that can. That seems pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think it will send anyone to take her place. I don't think that it should. I think Catswain, honestly, I think after Rand's epiphany, he's going to renege on his kill on order site, or kill on site order to of Catswain. So he will bring her back as the advisor she was, and maybe even actually listen to her more. I don't know.
That'd be a swoop, wouldn't it? Yeah, I think he'll have to rescind his order at some point in time. It's just not going to work, especially if they're continually being thrown together. And even Rand eventually will realize that she's not arranging that. It's just happening. One thing about Rand is that he is pretty sensible of the fact that the pattern does what it needs to do, and it's thrown him up in order to achieve the destiny that he needs to achieve and the goals he needs to achieve. And I think he does realize that people are put into his path for a reason, and people are thrown into his sphere of influence for a reason that's sometimes larger than what he does or doesn't want. He's become darker, but he hasn't become stupid. You know, he's not insensible to the things that happen around him. He's just so stressed out that he reacts, you know, on a momentary basis to things. And sometimes he thinks twice about it later and regrets it. Sometimes I think he feels that he can't change it or he can't back down. But I don't think this is one of those cases. I think something is going to happen that's going to make it obvious to him that he really needs Catswain around. I hope so anyway, because I think she's a pretty key character. I know a lot of people don't like her, but I really do. She's annoying, but I really do like her.
Yeah, every once in a while she has her good part.
There's a couple of more interesting, other interesting things in here. The one is that Rand doesn't trust anyone but Min. I don't know why Catswain doesn't think he trusts Nynaeve. We know he does, but for some reason she doesn't add. I wonder what Catswain has against Nynaeve that she didn't add her, or if it's just, you know, if it means nothing. Or if it actually means something that she doesn't think of Nynaeve at that point.
I don't know. I think there's a part of Rand that doesn't trust Nynaeve, because even though Moraine told him that he should trust no woman that wore the shawl at that time, that did not include Nynaeve, Egwene, and Elaine. So they were safe from that warning. But I think there's a part of him that really just doesn't trust anyone who is or ever will be Aes Sedai, and maybe not even anybody who can channel. I think that's why he really does trust, really
but that would include
no
Avienda and Elaine.
Yeah, but I think he even thinks they have their own motives and everything. I think he trusts them, but maybe not as much. You know, because she didn't include them either. He said she trusts no one but men. Maybe she was thinking locally, but then again, my niece left out. So I don't know. That's an interesting observation. Did she actually say that word for word?
He didn't trust Aes Sedai with good reason. He didn't seem to trust anyone save perhaps for men.
Yeah, well, there's something else here. And I'm trying to figure out who he's talking to. Who is the she that he's talking to here? He's talking to Flynn and Knife. What did she say it was? Neff? Nace? I need to listen to that again. Okay, here it is on page 479. Nynaeve approaches. She talks to him. She says, Rand, and he turns, not having heard Nynaeve's voice approach. She wore a bold green dress, modest by demonic standards, but still far more revealing than she'd ever have considered during the days in the Two Rivers. She has a right to change, Rand thought. What is a loosening of dress compared to the fact that I have ordered exiles and executions? What did you decide, she asked. We will meet them at Falmouth, he said. She muttered quietly. What was that, he asked? Oh, just something about you being a wool-headed fool, she said, looking at him with defiant eyes. Alma will be agreeable to them. Presumably this is a Shanshan. Yes, she said. It puts you perfectly within their hands. I cannot afford to wait, Nynaeve. This is a risk we must take, but I doubt they will attack. Did you doubt it last time, too? She asked. The time when they took your hand? He glanced down at the stump. They are unlikely to have one of the Forsaken with them this time. You can be sure? He met her eyes and she held them, something few people could seem to manage these days. Finally, he shook his head. I cannot be sure. She sniffed in response, indicating that she'd won the argument. Well, we'll just have to be extra careful. Perhaps memories of the last time you visited Falmouth will make them uncomfortable. I hope so, he said. She muttered something else to herself, but he didn't catch it. Nynaeve would never make an ideal Aes Sedai. She was far too free with her emotions, particularly her temper. Rand did not find it a fault. At least he always knew where he stood with Nynaeve. She was terrible at games, and that made her valuable. He trusted her. She was one of the few. We do trust her, don't we? Luce Theron asked. Can we? Rand didn't answer. So, wait, here's more. He completed his review of the docks. Nynaeve stayed at his side. She seemed to be in a dark mood, though Rand couldn't see why. With Kentswain's banishment, Nynaeve could fill the role as his primary advisor. Didn't that please her? So he's thinking of Nynaeve as his advisor. This is actually in the next chapter. We should probably put it then.
Yeah,
but he says to himself that he trusts her. Luce Theron wonders about it, but why is Cantswain wondering about it? Yeah, you know, what has he ever given Cantswain to think that she does not trust Nynaeve? Or is that just an omission in the notes here?
No,
it
says he doesn't trust any Aes Sedai. In fact, he doesn't trust much of anyone except perhaps men. And he didn't trust Aes Sedai, and with good reason. He didn't seem to trust anyone save perhaps for men. But men had resisted every attempt that Cantswain had made at involving her. The girl was almost as bad as Althor.
Yeah, she's pretty much been dancing around Cantswain the whole time. I think she kind of broke down. You know, she kind of broke down on Carian when he was wounded by Fane's dagger and confided a little bit in Cantswain. But other than that, she's pretty much kept her at arm's length, I think. So that's interesting. I have to say that my perception of this is probably that this is just Cantswain's perception of who Rand was. And, you know, she can't lie, but she can certainly be wrong.
Yeah, we know that the Aes Sedai can be wrong, and are frequently.
And then I said she can't lie, but then, or can she? She hasn't taken the new oath. We don't know. I have always said I don't think that Cantswain is Black Aja because, and I rest this mostly on one scene, and I don't remember what book it was in, where Cantswain is reflecting to herself that she had nearly rooted out the Black Aja at one point in time, but had failed. Now, people can be really seriously twisted, but they rarely lie to themselves when they're thinking in their own heads. So that's what I'm gonna base my thing on. Unless she's done a Viren, and I can't imagine that Robert Jordan would use that twist again.
Well, and also going into the special book that Egwene has, Cantswain is not on the list either.
No, so I have to say that probably Cantswain is not Black.
Yeah.
With fair certainty. Like I said,
Of course, that doesn't mean that she can't lie.
It doesn't mean that she can't lie. She might have been broken free of some of the oaths. I think that's extremely possible, and I can't imagine that other than the swearing and re-swearing necessity for the oath rod, it always seemed to me that that discovery of Pavara's opened the door towards other Aes Sedai maybe intentionally or inadvertently being broken free of the three oaths and maybe only retaking one or two or none, but still being Aes Sedai, just like Sawan and Lyanna. They're not evil. They're not Black Aja. They're not bad people. They just got stilled, and that broke the oath, and they just haven't taken them again.
Yep.
You know?
Interesting side note question that we shouldn't spend too much time discussing, but do you think that the purge of the Black Aja that happens later in this book, do you think that that's going to be in the public histories, or do you think that's going to be in the 13th Depository?
I think that's going to have to be public. The breaking of the tower is so obviously public. I mean, the near destruction of the tower by the Shan Chan, all these things, they're not going to be able to hide that stuff.
Well,
and
yes,
I don't think,
but the purge
think,
of the Black Aja,
they,
I think was handled internally, wasn't something that anyone really knew about. And
well,
so I think that the actual purge, I think the other histories will be there, and the actual purge will be in the 13th Depository.
But there were enough of them that how are they ever going to explain the fact that so many women were executed? I mean, so many women that were known to be Aes Sedai, gone. And
yes, but if they let it be made common knowledge that the Aes Sedai had rebels within and that they have the ability to remove the oaths when they want, they will no longer have the power, the scheming political power that they had.
That's true. That's true. Once it becomes known, well, they may keep that part secret about the oath rod without revealing, I mean, you know, well, I don't know. I mean, surely they would want to cover up the Black Aja, but then again, the last battle's coming, and a lot of things are going to change. It may be that the White Tower will need to prove that it has purged itself of the Black Aja just to make itself more credible and stronger. In other words, they got taken, and they were infiltrated, but we discovered them in their history. You know, but they don't need to reveal that the oaths can be removed or any of that in order to say that they've purged the Black Aja. They can just say in typical Aes Sedai fashion that, you know, incontrovertible tests were used to determine that each woman still allied with the White Tower is in fact not a dark friend. They don't have to say what it was. That's part of the awe, increasing the awe and mystery of the Aes Sedai, as Liana said.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I just think it's going to be something that's kind of shoved off into a corner that's not known beyond the walls of Tar Valon. Obviously, all of those in Tar Valon are going to know about it, but I don't think beyond the... Anyway, and then the last thing, going back to the Cadswain's point of view, one last thing that I want to touch on because it's really kind of important. Rance Tavarin effect is now all negative. It has no positive effects. There aren't the marriages and the miraculous survivings of three-story window jumps. There's just balconies falling off on either side of the road concurrently. There's stillborn children, men dying from falls that should barely have caused a bruise, stones toppling from buildings and striking women dead as they trade. Gary stuff.
That makes me wonder two things. One, in later chapters, another spoiler, now that Rand has had his change of heart and his epiphany, is there going to be a period of time where all of his influence will be positive in order to balance that? Will he now become known as a miracle worker because of the positive effects that are going to have to happen, or I think will have to happen in order to bring things back into balance? And who's keeping track of all this stuff? How do we know that no positive things are happening? Who's the official tabulator of Tavarin effects in the city?
Well, we don't know, but this is when Cad Swain is talking to Quillen. And so he has heard no stories of the positive effects, you know, marriages on the rise or unexpected fortunes discovered beneath the floorboards of a pauper's house or anything like that. And so you've heard no such stories, Cad Swain asked with surprise. No, my lady, I can ask around if you wish and do so.
That's interesting. I wonder also, is it strictly Rand's Tavarin effect not having any positive and all negative, or is it just the general unraveling of the pattern that's twisting everything to be more negative and just overwhelming the amount of positive effects. Or, if that is true, if the pattern itself is unraveling to the point where we have negativity. In other words, we've only seen, you know, the dead walking, villages, you know, melting into the ground. We've only seen the horrible bubbles of evil and their wild, random, chaotic effect. We've never seen anything positive happening because of that. Is that just what's taking over, the pattern disintegrating, and Rand is becoming less Taviran? You know, they're only Taviran for a time. Maybe the effects are wearing off. You know, maybe he's done what he needed to do with the Taviran effect, and the pattern is winding them down.
It could
There's
be.
One of his big edges in the last battle, if that's true.
Yeah, we don't know. We have no idea.
Yeah,
we don't know why the pattern is. We don't know why the pattern has started spinning in a what appears to be a more negative pattern. We don't know what changes will come after Rand's epiphany on Dragon Mound, if any. I mean, I take that back. We have seen that the clouds are the oppressive, looming storm clouds that were everywhere are now breaking up. And this is, well, I can't decide. Yes, I'm going to go into spoiler mode. I'm now going to give spoilers for Towers of Midnight. It sounds odd. It's not, because Brandon Sanderson has released samples of, and Tor have released sample chapters from Towers of Midnight. And I have read these. The one that I'm referring to specifically is the one that was revealed because of the Great Hunt marketing campaign.
Okay.
And there is a point in that when Matt reflects to himself that the clouds are actually breaking up and that there is actual sunlight that can be seen.
Mm.
So, it's not all bad. And I take that to mean that since the epiphany and, you know, we saw the clouds spreading in the epilogue, and I assume, since we've seen the, and I'm looking to see if I can actually find it, but I'm assuming that the clouds, obviously we saw the circle above Dragon Mount, or we see that in the epilogue, and we didn't know whether or not that was going to spread, whether or not the storm would stop everywhere, but apparently it has, and I'm trying to find, oh, here we are. Let's see, the streets of Camelon were busy even at this late hour. The paving stones were damp from a recent shower, though those clouds had passed and remarkably left the sky open to the air. That's really, really weird.
Well, there was always regular weather in addition to the weird silver and black clouds.
Well, that's not quite what I'm referring to right now. I'm referring to the fact that I'm doing a search on the page. I did a search on the page for clouds. And you heard me, I just read them. I read them off the page, but apparently they don't exist on the page anywhere.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, enough spoilers of Towers of Midnight. I'm excited that we actually got to do spoilers for Towers of Midnight before the book came out. That's amazing.
I know. Well, Tor released the spoilers, so it's not our fault.
Yeah, that's true.
But on the other hand, we are mentioning it, so we're spoiling it. If you haven't read those little chapters yet, you're in trouble.
Yep.
So I guess the question, we go back to it, is Servan's Taviran effect now becoming all negative because of his increasing darkness? Or is Rand's Taviran effect the same as it always has been, but the general disintegration of the pattern basically sucking the good out of everything to the point where you can't tell any positive effect? Or is Rand becoming less Taviran? Three possibilities there.
Yeah. Well, my personal theory is that that Rand is still as strong as Taviran as he always was, but now that he has this tenuous connection with the Dark One through the actual use of the True Power, he has a connection to the True Power and the Dark One is able to take his thread, his Taviran-ness, and twist it to his own purposes.
So, here's my next crazy theory, is Rand, well, now that he's had the quote-unquote epiphany, that's probably not likely, but a possible plot twist that I considered with him becoming so dark was that Rand could actually become Nae Bliss, either willingly or unwillingly. In other words, if he's been touched by the Dark One and touching the Dark One that much, he might not have as much conscious ability to resist. So if he became Nameless and the Dark One's champion and then turned again back to the light, you know, that would be a possible plot twist. But now that he's shed some of his darkness, maybe that's not true. But he still has the connection to Moradin. He still has the connection of having used the true power, which apparently stems directly from the Dark One, according to the various references in the books. He may have had an internal change, but is he going to be able to shake those connections, you know, enough to make a difference? We don't know yet.
No, we don't.
I'm wondering,
and,
too.
And it's something that we should kind of worry about, I think.
Yeah, those evil influences are still there, even though he's still got the wounds in his side.
He's got Moradin in his head. He's got all sorts of crazy things going on.
Yeah, he's touched the true power. You know, he's still got to live with what he did. He's bale-fired women. He's broken his last rule. You know, he's played the Dark One's little game, and that's still going to have an effect on him, even though he apparently has shed the chaotic influence of Luthien, which is, that's kind of good news, bad news to me, because Luthien actually, I'm kind of discomforted by what happened with that. I mean, basically the resolution of that seemed to be that there was really no actual Luthien in his head, but he got so much information, actual physical, usable information from that quote-unquote voice in his head. It seems impossible to me that it could have just been, you know, a psychological disturbance. He learned weeds from Luthien.
He
got information from Luthien that he couldn't have got just from hearing a voice in his head that was inside his own head and no actual person from the Age of Legends. I mean, he learned how to do that construct that killed all the Trollocs. He learned how to unknot weaves when he was in the box. He learned how to do death gates and blossoms of fire. He learned real stuff from this quote-unquote voice in his head. There had to be some reality to it. Had to be.
Well, yeah, and if I may quickly give my own personal theory, and this is, again, something that we'll talk on later when we reach the relevant chapter, but my own quick theory, well, not my own, it's not my own quick theory, but a quick theory that I think has a lot of water to it is that Rand is getting the bleed through from his former life, and he's getting the memories of Luthien, and the way his psyche dealt with it, rather than going the Matt route and just having this jarring experiences when you're remembering things that aren't yours, the way his psyche dealt with it is it created a second personality, a split personality, which, you know, schizophrenia, yay, that housed, that quote-unquote housed those memories and was the key and became Luthien because it was created based on the memories of the former life.
If there was ever anybody who had a license to have schizophrenia, it would be Randall Thor. But the difference is, the only one he really created out of his head of whole cloth, if what you're saying is true, was Luthien. Everything else was laid on him from outside. You know, they're actual real people. You know, he's got Mick, he's got Elaine, he's got Aviana, he's got Alana, he's got Moradin.
He's got Matt and Perrin. Yeah,
he's
got a lot of voices up in there.
Yeah, well, Matt and Perrin are visuals. He's got audio video with them. But those are all real people that he has a real connection to. You know, that's why it seems odd to me that the first one and the most persistent one was just a figment of his imagination or a bleed through from a past life, because that was really up close and personal. And how was that voice able to dredge up bleed through from the past on demand? In other words, they're in trouble at the manor house in Tyr, with 10,000 Trollocs or more descending upon them, and suddenly he's able to access on demand the bleed through from his past life to get death gates and blossoms of fire. I don't know. That seems a little too convenient to me. Usually schizophrenia is not that ordered. You know, it's not, he had to get that information from somewhere. Bleed through from past lives isn't normally that specific and immediate and able to be called upon during an emergency. Not that I've ever heard.
Yeah, I don't know. Well,
could be wrong. Could be wrong.
And again, it's something we'll talk about when we get into the later chapters. So now I think we've exhausted our Cad Swain point of view here. And so we want to go on to the other point of view in chapter 31, which is from Rand. And it starts out with him riding Kaidashar through Bandari Bon with his entourage, which includes Naif, Flynn, and Nynaeve. Naif is bound to Nelavir Demiselin, who is a green sister, and I butchered that name, I'm sorry. He was one of the Queen's Guard in Andor until he left in disgust after Gabriel took over. A lot of people seem to do that. I should stop editorializing. They're going to review the activity unloading and dispersing. That doesn't make much sense.
Yeah,
they're going to review activity unloading and dispersing food at docks. And it sort of makes sense. Rand spots Cad Swain and thinks that she's following him. Naif and Bashir have been negotiating a meeting with the Daughter of the Nine Moons. The Shanshan rejected Qatar, so Rand proposes Falme, even though it is deep in their territory. Luz Theron has been quiet lately. Rand asks Nynaeve if Lon is riding to Malkier, and she admits that he is. He will reach Tarwyn's Gap in 2 or 3 months. Rand says that if he attacks with only a small force, he deserves what he gets. Nynaeve is shocked and angry. When they return to the mansion, he meets with Rurark. Rand has still not decided what to do about Ossalam. Rurark reports that they have found another of the Council of Merchants, Alamindra Kutrin. Meashan Dubaris is dead. That makes 4 captured and 2 dead. They need 4 more for a legal vote for a new king. Milisar Chadmar stands to the side looking disheveled. Rand dismisses Rurark, then summons her. She reluctantly reports that the messenger from King Al-Salam is dead. Jelani reports that they caught her trying to flee. Lord Ramshalan, who hates her, suggests she should be executed. Rand orders her locked in her own dungeon, where she held the messenger. Rand asks if any others of the Merchant Council have heard from the king, and a clerk named Noraladam reports that they have not. Luz Theron points out that if Grendel sent the messenger, then Rand would never have been able to break compulsion. After she is taken away, Nynaeve confronts Rand again about Lon. She asks if he cares about Perrin and Matt. Rand sees a quick image of Perrin with Galad, who is now a white cloak, and then he sees Matt and Tom riding through a city, which he assumes is Camelin. Rand tells Nynaeve that they are alive and well, and she asks him how he knows, and he says that he just does. She's not ready to reveal all his secrets yet. She asks him again if he cares, and he replies that he only cares about the last battle. She then goes into matronly motherly mode, telling him that he is destroying himself, and he explodes at her. His temper flares, and he threatens that he may have to banish her as well. He looks forward to dying now as much as Luz Theron, and actually promises him again that they can die. So there's a lot in here of names that you may or may not know. If you're wondering who the heck we are talking about, then I exhort you to go to Encyclopedia Watt, encyclopedia-watt.org, and get to the chapter summary for this chapter, because they will have links there for each and every single one of the names that is mentioned, and you can find out who the heck these people are.
I do notice that Nynaeve, I had forgotten, has just done what I accused her not of doing, which is confronting Rand about, well, tangentially confronting him about his hardness. She tells him that he's destroying himself. A little overdue, a little too late, but at least she did.
Yeah, and it's really, really, really interesting. And almost really scary.
Totally.
This actually comes up twice, and this is the first time which we had kind of talked, well, it's the second kind that I brought up, the second time that I brought up earlier. This is the first time that I had actually forgotten about until went back into reading the summaries and such. And this time he has a completely different reaction than he has the second time. This time he literally, here we go. Rand's anger surged. He spun, pointing at her. Would you end up exiled like Cad Swain, Nynaeve? I will not be played with. I am done with that. Give me advice when it is asked for, and the rest of the time do not patronize me.
obviously he's bellowing this at the top of his lungs. He's screaming, shouting, ranting, raving at her. Oh, and this is interesting. The next paragraph, she recoiled and Rand gritted his teeth, forcing the anger back down. He lowered his hand, but realized it had begun to reach reflexively for the access key in the pocket at his side.
Whoa. That's pretty
scary. Nynaeve's eyes fixed on it, opening wide, and he slowly forced his hand away from the statuette. This is really scary when you realize that with that, not only could he balefire her out of existence, but almost even worse, he could sever her.
Yeah.
He has the power. He can sever anyone he wants to, especially with the Chosen Call.
Oh, yeah. Well, and he just got through, you know, threatening in the last episode, he just got through threatening Cadswain with the idea that he didn't even have to do anything except will the pattern to bend itself around them, you know, to erase her from existence, let alone steal her. I mean, we're approaching the point where he's become so powerful that he could almost kill with a thought, with a careless thought, which he just, you know, he didn't even need the Chosen Call for it. And yet he's reaching for that to Nynaeve. And his rage has so overtaken him that he's almost ready to balefire one of the few people that he still likes and trusts. Well, I don't know how much he ever really liked Nynaeve, but he cares for her. He really does. And he's that close. I actually can't believe that he never did that to Cadswain because she's far more irritating than Nynaeve.
Well, and then eventually we're going to come to a point where I just read the chapter rather than doing the summary because they are so well written. Oh, yeah. I love it.
Made of Awesome is lately
they are made of awesome, yes. But and it goes on, the explosion surprised him. He had thought his temper controlled.
No, I'm sorry. His temper is never under control anymore. I mean, it is because he isn't lashing out wildly and balefiring everything in existence, but
he's not randomly picking up Kalindor and shooting lightnings at the hillside and killing people.
No, that's true. Well, that was partly Kalindor's fault, not his. Remember, Cadswain said it lacks the buffer that most Songreal have, and it induces wildness of mind. That really wasn't his fault.
That's
that wasn't
true.
Him going crazy. That wasn't him going crazy. That was him not knowing how to use Kalindor property in a circle guided by the woman, which is how it was designed to be used, but he didn't know it. He just figured, hey, he drew it out of the Stone of Tear. It was his to use, da-da-da.
Yep.
Now, he's feeling his way blind with a lot of this stuff, but I don't really think, yes, his temper has been under control, but he says he hasn't just blindly lashed out and killed anybody that he loves, like Lucerne or anything like that. But on the other hand, it really isn't very under control. He's having to really ride it constantly. He constantly lets it, and it just overtakes him, and it ramps up to the point where he has to make a conscious effort to damp it back down and to not do anything with it. So, yeah, it's under control, but just barely. Just barely. And here we see him ready to lash out as one of his oldest friends from his hometown, somebody that he probably still does actually trust and like. But then, you know, Nynaeve, like Cadswain, could irritate a brick, so I suppose it's not surprising that she could induce that in somebody that's on the edge like he is.
I don't like Nynaeve in this chapter. Really, I don't. I don't like Nynaeve in a lot of this book. It seems like now that Lon is no longer by her side, she's kind of reverted back to annoying Nynaeve, the one that we really, really didn't like in the first couple of books.
But I think the other interesting thing in here, and I think what obviously what's pushed Nynaeve to confront him like that is his attitude toward Lon. I mean, we've seen that he has a real connection with Lon. Lon is the one that taught him the sword. He's basically his mentor and a friend. And he's even expressed the fact that he thinks of him as a good friend and cares what happens to him. And he would go a long way out of his way, I think, to save Lon. And then casually he's ready to toss him away. Well, if he rides to Tarmin's Gap with a tiny force, he'll get whatever he deserves. That's really a casual throwaway comment about somebody that he really does care about. Where'd that come from? It's like the more he's ramped himself up that he can't kill a woman, the less he seems to care if he lets a man be killed or kills a man. I guess it's all part of the hardness and everything. He thinks that he's not supposed to care about anybody except his destiny and winning the last battle.
I'm so glad to see the last chapter. The last chapter is a very, very nice relief from the stupidity that has been Rand.
in the recent book.
I mean, because he was really going all Darth Vader on us. I mean, you know, Darth Vader, of course, willing to use his own son and daughter to turn him to the dark side for, you know, in the service of his master, the Emperor. But, man, it's just like he's basically willing to throw away everybody at this stage. That's just weird. I mean, you almost wonder if maybe Luce Theron isn't taking over more of his personality than we really see. I mean, I know he's trying to make himself hard. I know he's trying to make himself capable of doing what he needs to do, but some of this is just so un-Rand-like that it's too weird for words.
It is. It's weird. Don't like.
So, again, you know, we still see in this chapter that Rand is weaving his little plots together. He's got, you know, he's ramping up to go get Grendel. He's figuring out a way to set her up so that he can definitely balefire her. And he's, you know, negotiating with the Shan Chan to meet with the Daughter of the Nine Moons, which is, well, I don't know about that. That's one of those good news, bad news things that has the potential to go so terribly wrong.
And it does.
And it does. but it has
spoiler
the potential
warning.
To, yeah. But it has the potential to do what he needs it to do, which it still might. But, you know, the idea, the very idea of him meeting with Tuan in his present state of mind, boy. You know, that actually takes me back, and this is only slightly appropriate to this chapter, but I wanted to bring it up earlier, and I didn't. I am doing my read-through of The Wheel of Time, and I've gotten to, you know, Crown of Swords, Path of Daggers, and there is a, you know, we were talking about Rand's Tavirinness and whether it's gone completely dark or whether it's the pattern taking over or whatever, but there's a point. And I can't remember which of those two books it is now, and I don't have time to look it up. But Varen reflects on the plot by Elida's sisters to take Rand back to the White Tower. And she reflects that the very idea of a Tavirin of his strength actually within the walls of the White Tower made her shudder. I mean, it beggared the imagination. Now, why do you think she said that? What would a Tavirin of Randolph Orr's strength inside the White Tower do? Exactly.
I have no idea.
All kinds of...
I mean, we've seen what he can do just to a city of regular peoples and regular folks. Imagine if he did show up at the White Tower and all these things that didn't usually happen or happened only once in a very, very, not very often, just suddenly becoming everyday occurrences. I mean, the least of it would be all the Greens getting married to their warders. Maybe even some of the Reds getting warders. That would be weird. Reds start bonding people. That would be creepy.
That already happened without him. We've got Reds bonding warders, for crying out loud.
Yes, but they're channeling men, so.
Yeah, well, it was still. I mean, let's face it, 6 months ago in this book, the idea of the Reds bonding anything, I mean, they wouldn't have bonded a pet cat, for crying out loud.
And then, you know, while he was there, they probably would have had 17 different Armalins, with at least 5 of them having been deposed, 6 of them dying in their sleep, 3 of them stepping down because they decided they didn't want to be Armalin anymore. They wanted to live on a farm.
but it seems to me that Varen was worried about something specific. You know, not just general chaos, but, you know, some specific, really unpleasant result. And, you know, especially with, you know, a dark Tavirin, as Rand is becoming.
Would have been creepy.
That's another question. Are there Tavirin among the Dark One's minions?
I don't think there are right now, but I think if the pattern ever needed to... Because the pattern is neutral. It strives for neutrality. So if it ever got going too much to the good side, it would weave a dark friend Tavirin to bring it back neutral. I don't think
we
have that right now. I don't think that is existing right now. I think we're going too much to... The dark side of the Force, and so it needs light friend Tavirin to bring everything back to neutrality, but
suddenly, for the first time in at least in known history, we have 3 fairly strong light friend Tavirins running around. Is that only bringing things back in balance because the dark one has become so strong, or is that going to put it out of balance again? I mean, this whole thing reminds me of the, you know, since you brought up the Force, this whole thing reminds me of the Jedi seeking for the Chosen One to bring balance back to the Force. Now, what were they thinking? Hello? There's maybe 1 or 2 Sith that they know of running around, and everybody else is good guy Jedi. what would you think it was going to happen when the balance, when the force came back into balance? Duh.
Mm-hmm.
It's already weighted to the light side. I think I wouldn't be looking for that.
Well, I think that Qui-Gon was the only one who wasn't paying too much attention to that. I think that let's not get into Star Wars theory.
Well, I know, but still.
Anyway. Yeah,
still,
it is a good crossover. It is a good.
But they're all worried about bringing, you know, balance in the universe and the pattern bringing things into balance. And it seems to me that probably from what we've been told, the Dark One has become so strong and there are enough, you know, we've already got the 13 Forsaken that maybe, you know, 3 Taviran light friends, one of whom is a channeler, are not enough to bring it back into balance. So that means to me that we either need what we're kind of getting anyway, which is fewer of the Chosen or the Forsaken running around, because Rand's taken out any number of them already, although so many of them have come back, it almost doesn't matter.
Oh, and I can't believe that they haven't been replaced either.
Yeah, the ones that didn't get Balefired surely have been.
Warning, Tyene theory.
You know, we don't know that Asmodian was Balefired.
We do know that he's not coming back, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, because he was
the
a traitor.
The Dark Lord has said, I'm not bringing him back.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So we don't have Asmodian to worry about. I don't know. You know, are the 3 boys enough to balance off the remaining
Forsaken? I think they are. I really think they are, because you look at Matt and Perrin, who are the weaker of the Taviran. Honestly, if I had to choose one, I'd say Perrin was the weakest.
Oh, absolutely.
But either of them are as powerful as Taviran as Archer Hawkwing was. And
yeah.
Archer Hawkwing was so powerful that you could, that rumor had it, that you could see the pattern twisting itself around him. And Rand is even more powerful than that.
Yeah.
And so I think that they are powerful enough as Taviran that they can bring the pattern back into balance.
But
The thing is, to bring the pattern back into balance doesn't mean that they fight for the side of the good. It doesn't mean that they fight for the light. It means that they fight for neutrality. Which is different.
Yeah, here's another crossover. See, we don't have any Dungeons and Dragons type neutrals. You know, we don't have any dedicated neutrals that we know of. I mean, the White Tower would like to think they are, but they're not. They meddle incessantly, but for
they're
the most
very
part,
much light friends.
Yeah, for the most part.
Except for the Black
friends.
Aja.
Well, except for the Black Aja, yeah, except for them. But they're out of here now, most of them. But
well, so
the White Tower as a whole is neutral. What?
So the White Tower as a whole is neutral because they have the regular sisters who are fighting for the light and the Black Aja who are working constantly against the light, and they balance each other out and they're neutral. There you go.
Well, but there weren't enough numbers of the black to totally balance out. Unless you feel, as a lot of people do, that the whole Red Aja was pretty much a batch of dark friends in the first place. But
no.
I always thought it was odd that the Red Aja was the largest in number. That seems bizarre to me. It seems like they'd be the smallest, except for maybe the white. Not very many logical people laying around.
And yet
anyway,
the blue was the smallest. I don't know.
Yeah, that seems odd to me. Blue is just made for meddlers, and that's what all Aja Sedai seem to be.
Anyway,
I was just going to also say that, you know, on the other side, you know, we have had all this time more Forsaken than we have powerful light friend Taviran anyway, although you could consider maybe the 3 girls to be, you know, counterweights for the Forsaken, and maybe a couple of the other Aes Sedai that we've seen, like Moraine and Cadswain. The dark side also has a number of spooky, scary things, like Murdral, hordes of Trollocs. Okay, those can be weighted against maybe ordinary soldiers, but I mean, let's face it, most Trollocs are a match for any 2 or 3 average soldiers that aren't Taviran. Or, you know,
or Borderlanders.
Super warriors, yeah, super warriors in one sense or another. And they also have things like the Golam and Grey Men and, you know, any number of other little nasty, tricksy things that they can fill out. So it still seems to me like the Dark is overwhelmed with more power than the Light has.
We have Eludra's Dragon, so we're good.
No, they don't match up with superpower things like Golam and Murdral. No way. They're just cannons. Give me a break. Cannons are nice. In that age, they're a big deal, but they're not that big of a deal. They're certainly not going to affect, you know, large areas of the pattern. I mean, they're going to take out a lot of foot soldiers, but not much else. They're not going to do anything against, you know, well, they might take out a few Murdral if they're lucky, but let's face it.
And the Dreadlords.
Dark...
They'll take out large swaths of the Dreadlords. Because the Dreadlords will be so fixated on channeling and blocking Wheeze of the power and not paying much attention, because we've seen this is the common side effect of pretty much all channelers except for Rand, that because they can channel, they don't, and the wise ones. Because they can channel, they don't worry too much about the physical harm that may come to them. And so they won't be bothering with, oh, there's someone throwing rocks at us, big whoop, then they blow up, and you lose 5 or 10 Dreadlords.
No, I disagree, because even Mazrim Taim was able to figure out that the Ashaman needed to learn how to throw up a shield around themselves before they started channeling these powers that were going to throw rocks and shards and shrapnel and stuff around. You know, he even taught them, and he wasn't even, well, we don't think, he might be, but you didn't know that he was a Dreadlord, but he was able to figure out, you
he's
know,
at
shield
least
yourself
a
before you, yeah, at least he is, I think, but, you know, he was able to teach them, you know, the Ashaman, shield yourself before you strike, or you may end up killing yourself, duh. I'm sure the Dreadlords throw up a shield around themselves to prevent fireballs and anything physical that might come bouncing at them, and it'll deflect a cannonball. If it can deflect a fireball or lightning bolts, it'll deflect a cannonball.
If they just tie a weave around themselves, or tie a shield around themselves, it'll easily be taken down. Just, it's gone, honestly.
By what?
By someone slicing the weave. A channeler come along and slice down the shield's gone.
Well, you've got to have
to channel it. If you're constantly maintaining it, then no. But if you just tie a shield around yourself, oh yeah, a channeler can get that thing down in seconds.
Yeah, but they have to go ahead and do that and then have a cannonball at them almost simultaneously. Otherwise, they'll just reweave a shield. I mean, skilled channelers, they don't take 20 minutes to do a weave like Garen did with her compulsion. They throw that up in an eye blink, you know, bam. They can almost see a fireball coming at them and throw up a shield. It's almost second nature. A shield and strike simultaneously. I mean, a lot of them can split their weaves any number of different ways, like Egwene can and Elaine. I think Nynaeve can, too, split her weaves.
Yeah, the strongest channelers can, yeah. I'm not sure that any of the Dreadlords will be strong enough to... I think the stronger channelers for the Dark Friends will all have become Forsaken, and the rest of them will be somewhere in the middling ranges.
Yeah, I think your average Dreadlord or your average Aes Sedai could throw up a shield if they knew how to do it. I don't think it takes that much. There's one more comment that I want to make on this chapter, and again, I give full credit to the chapter notes at encyclopediawatt.org. We actually get two quick looks into Towers of Midnight in this chapter, where Rand has seen, because of Nynaeve's mention of them, Rand has seen this, presumably the swirling colors and a vision of Matt and Perrin, and he sees Perrin and Galad have apparently joined forces, and also Matt and his army headed to Camelon to reunite with the rest of the band and to learn about the Tower of Genji, and we have to mention quickly that we do know that there is overlap in time between the Gathering Storm and Towers of Midnight in particular, and that's partly because of the way it was done, where Bandon basically was writing the whole thing originally as one book, as Robert Jordan intended, and then just because it couldn't be done in one book, he had to split it up in three. So there is time overlap the way there was between the Gathering Storm and Knife of Dreams as well. Do you have any other insights into that, Spencer?
One thing I do want to mention really quick is the brief view of Matt that we see in this chapter has him and Tom riding through Camelon, but the sample chapter that we get, Matt reflects to himself that he has not yet brought any horses into Camelon. So obviously we have there's even more time. It helps us kind of figure out the time difference here of where the chapters lie in conjunction with each other, where the books are and all that. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I know there are people that keep timelines like that and sort all this stuff out, but I have to tell you, it's probably beyond my capabilities. Quickly get confusing. So anyway, I guess this will wrap it up for this particular episode. Well, first of all, I want to thank Spencer for showing up on a Saturday morning to help record. And we love it. Sorry that Andrew couldn't be here. He had some last-minute working on his thesis-type work to do that was thrown at him, and he couldn't make it. So I want to thank everybody for listening, being with us yet again. And until we meet again, this is Virginia, and may the light illumine you.
And until next time, may you find water and shade. I challenge you, Dan Brown, if you ever listen to this, make that book. We'll
No, I'm yelling at children, so go ahead.
Oh.
I'm editorializing again. Jeez. Editor, I'm sorry. Just cut out all my editorializing because it shouldn't be there.
All salami all the time. Wait.
Oh, yeah, there you go. All salami all the time.